Welcome, wayward travelers, to the Scarlet Tavern, where stories are told in candlelight and truth is chased like spirits in a bottle. Imagine volunteering to become a United States Marine, earning the title, wearing the uniform, taking on the same brutal training, and then being told, yeah, but not with the rest of them. That's the story of the Montford Point Marines, thousands of black men who forced their way into an institution that didn't want them there, trained under segregation, and still came out the other side as Marines, disciplined, relentless, and impossible to dismiss. In this episode, we're going to follow the story up to the moment they're fully forged, before the battlefield chapters take over. We'll unpack why the Marine Corps resisted black enlistment longer than the other branches, what political and wartime pressure finally cracked the door open, and why the Corps' solution was to create a separate boot camp at Montford Point. Then, we'll step inside that world, what training looked like, what daily life felt like, what kinds of roles they were pushed toward, and how the men at Montford Point built a legacy while living inside a contradiction. This episode includes discussions of racism, segregation, and discriminatory policies, handled respectfully and with focus on the people who lived it. To understand why Montford Point had to exist at all, you must understand how the Marine Corps fought to make sure it wouldn't. This is Scarlet Tavern. Huzzah! Okay. So, our sound effects are thanks to our wonderful app at Pocketbard. Thank you to our friends at Pocketbard for allowing us to use this. They do have a tavern setting, just like you're in here. You can go from this exploration music, this background music, we can layer vocals at some point. Is she gonna sing? She can do vocals. We can throw it into combat mode. Obviously, this is meant for D&D, which, as most of you know, is our other business, is what sparked all of this anyways, but we use this for D&D, and it's amazing. Everything from tavern to a tainted chapel, which is what you guys were just hearing earlier.
Oh, yeah, that was creepy, by the way.
To space and things like that. So there's so many different things. Little one-shots like you heard of the cheering and pouring drinks and things like that. So check them out. You can download the app. You can do it for free. It gives you access to certain things. But if you pay, I believe it's $9.99 a month, you get full access to over, I believe it's 30 different scenes. Most of them have like 40 one-shots in them, things like that. So they're awesome. You're going to start hearing that in Scarlet Tavern now. But yeah, so let's get started. Again, this does involve racism, segregation, discrimination. Obviously, we do not support any of this, but I think it's crucial to talk about because it's Black History Month. So for those listeners, happy Black History Month.
And is some wording in here that,
yes, you'll hear some terms from official statements, and obviously this is not our terms, but it's important for the narrative. So, for most of its history, the Marine Corps didn't just lag behind the rest of the U.S. military on race. It drew a bright, deliberate line and dared anyone to challenge it. And that line wasn't fuzzy. It wasn't unofficial. It wasn't a quiet practice that people could pretend didn't exist. It was policy, baked in so deeply that for generations, African Americans were not allowed to be Marines. The NAACP, which for those that don't know is the National Association for Advancement of Colored People, in their own language on this is blunt. After a small number of Black Americans served in the Marine Corps during the Revolutionary War era, the Corps moved into a long stretch where it followed a discriminatory policy that denied African Americans the opportunity to serve as Marines, a span described as running from 1798 to 1942. That's not a short detour in the timeline. It is the timeline. So when people talk about the Montford Point Marines as the first, it's not just a celebratory label. It's an accusation because it raises an ugly question. If the country could mobilize millions for war, why did the Marine Corps still insist that Black Americans didn't belong in its ranks? And that answer sits at the intersection of two things the Corps treated as sacred: identity and control. The Marine Corps has always been obsessed with its self-image, elite, disciplined, different. That mythology can inspire courage, but it can also become a gate that opens only to those already inside it. When you convince yourself you're not just a branch of service, but a club or cult, you start acting like one. You decide who fits, you decide who doesn't, and then you dress those decisions up as traditions, efficiency, or unit cohesion. Like prejudice gets cleaner if you starch the uniform. And that's exactly how the leadership framed it. But in the early 1940s, the Corps' top brass wasn't shy about their contempt for the idea of Black Marines. The Commandant at the time, General Thomas Holcomb, didn't just resist. He mocked the entire premise. He argued that African Americans trying to enlist were, quote, trying to break into a club that doesn't want them. This single sentence tells you everything about the mindset. Not, we aren't prepared, or we need the time, or we have concerns, just you're not allowed. And Holcomb didn't leave it there. He delivered one of those quotes that doesn't need interpretation because it interprets itself. If it were a question of having a Marine Corps of 5,000 whites or 250,000 Negroes, I would rather have the whites. It's not dog whistle language, it's a bullhorn. It's also the point where the "it was a different time" excuse starts to crumble. Because here's the thing. Even at that time, other branches had already found ways, flawed, segregated, unequal ways, but ways to include Black Americans in uniform. The National Archives notes that the Army and the Navy allowed African Americans to join, even though they were segregated and often limited to specific ratings. But it contrasts contrasting that with the Marine Corps, which enforced complete racial discrimination, having never allowed African Americans to join. So this wasn't an impossibility nationwide. It was an institutional choice. And choices like that aren't held in place by policy memos alone. They're held in place by the culture that policy creates, the everyday understanding of who is supposed to be there. When a branch spends decades telling itself that Black Marines don't exist, it stops being an absence and becomes an ideology. The Corps didn't merely lack integration. It practiced exclusion as a form of control. Who gets to be one of us becomes a way to define what us means in the first place. And once an institution ties its identity to exclusion, letting people in just isn't just change. It feels like surrender. That's what makes Holcomb's club language so revealing. It's not just racism, though it absolutely is. It's the belief that the Marine Corps is a private room and the people inside have the authority to decide who counts as worthy. But war doesn't care about anyone's private room. War cares about numbers. War cares about labor. War cares about national unity, at least the appearance of it. And by the time the United States is staring down the reality of global conflicts, the Corps can cling to its identity all at once, but the world outside that club starts demanding a different set of numbers. Because while the Marine Corps is drawing the line, the country is changing around it. The government is preparing for a massive wartime effort. The military is expanding. Black Americans are demanding access not just to jobs and paychecks, but to citizenship and practice, meaning the right to serve, to advance, and to be recognized as full participants in the nation they're being asked to defend. And here's the most vital tension to sit with. The Marine Corps could hold the line as long as this remained an internal argument, but it didn't stay internal. Because once the question becomes national, political, economic, and moral, the Corps loses the ability to decide it on its own. So the line is drawn. The club has spoken. The gate is locked. And then the pressure starts to build outside the barracks, outside the Corps traditions, outside the comfort of pretending this is merely a Marine Corps decision. Next, we're going to follow the forces that push on the gate until it finally moves, how activism, wartime realities, and political necessity collide, and how the door opens just enough to change the Marine Corps forever. The thing about an institution drawing a hard line is that it only works as long as the institution controls the conversation. And by the early 1940s, the discussion about race, labor, and national defense wasn't happening inside the Marine Corps anymore. It was happening in factories, in union halls, in black newspapers, and increasingly in the White House. Because America wasn't just gearing up for war, it was gearing up for a massive war economy. Ships, planes, weapons, uniforms, steel, rubber, everything. And that war economy ran straight into a reality the country couldn't keep pretending wasn't there. Black Americans were being shut out of the shut out of defense industry jobs, even as the government insisted national unity was a matter of survival. That contradiction of we need everyone while still practicing discrimination created an opening. Not because the system suddenly grew a conscience, but because activists were ready to force the issue at precisely the moment the government could least afford instability. A. Philip Randolph, a prominent labor leader, understood something that feels obvious now, but was radical in real time. If the federal government cared about winning a global war, it could be pressured on the home front, especially where public embarrassment and economic disruption were possible. Randolph and allies pushed toward a march on Washington to protest discrimination in defense industries and the military, and crucially, they weren't talking about a symbolic crowd. They were talking about a number significant enough to turn the nation's capital into a headline you couldn't ignore. That looming march wasn't just activism as performance. It was activism as leverage. A war effort needs production lines running, unions functioning, and the appearance of a country marching in the same direction. A massive protest right as the defense program accelerates threatens all of that, politically, economically, and internationally. And the Roosevelt administration did what governments often do when pressure becomes unavoidable. It negotiated. The outcome was Executive Order 8802, signed June 25th, 1941. Here's why EO 8802 matters even before we get to the Marines. It wasn't a vague statement of values. It explicitly declared that there would be no discrimination in the employment of workers in defense industries or government based on race, creed, color, or national origin. And it created an enforcement mechanism, the Fair Employment Practices Committee, or the FEPC. Just as importantly, the National Archives milestone summary makes the political trade-off plain. Randolph called off the march in exchange for the order. So if you're listening to this and thinking, okay, this is about jobs, not the military, you're right. And you're not seeing the whole chain reaction yet. EO 8802 didn't instantly desegregate the armed forces. It didn't suddenly make the Marine Corps enlightened. What it did was establish a federal position, written, signed, and public, that discrimination within the defense program was now a liability the government was willing to address under pressure. That's a shift in terrain. Once the federal government has publicly committed to full participation in the defense program, you've created a new kind of political vulnerability. Any part of the defense system that still looks blatantly exclusionary becomes a target. Over the next year, you can watch the gears turning. The war expands. The military expands. The government needs bodies, skills, labor, and legitimacy. And suddenly, the Marine Corps' ability to hold its position without consequences starts to weaken. By June 1st, 1942, the Marine Corps began recruiting African Americans. Multiple sources identify Alfred Masters as the first African American to enlist on that date. That date is one of those moments that looks small on paper, just another recruiting policy change, but it's actually a structural crack in the wall. Because once the Corps begins recruiting, it can't pretend the question is hypothetical anymore. The question becomes logistical and operational. Where do you train them? Who leads them? What roles will they be allowed to fill? And how do you do all of that while still clinging to segregation? You shouldn't.
You shouldn't, but the Marine Corps found a way to.
Yeah.
Leave it to the jarheads to do it, to everything the hard way and be kicking and screaming to do the right thing.
Yeah.
The crayon eaters.
And this is where the door opening reveals the next truth. their Marine Corps wasn't just deciding to accept black recruits. It was deciding how to contain them. JSTOR Daily notes that when recruiting began, the Corps looked for men with skills needed to build the facilities where black Marines would train, because the system they were creating required infrastructure and quickly. Even some Marine Corps communications and later institutional summaries describe this bluntly and in practical terms. A Marine Corps-based Quantico history piece states that recruiting began on June 1, 1942, and notes that in early 1942, the Corps established a camp at Montford Point, and that $750,000 was allotted to construct and a large temporary barracks and supporting facilities for that segregated camp. It's a lot of money back then. A Camp Lejeune historical PDF is even more direct in showing the era's language and the framing used in recruiting. It describes a Corps beginning to recruit colored male citizens within a specified age range for service in a combat organization. That phrase, combat organization, is crucial because it signals that the Corps is not merely adding black recruits as a symbolic gesture. It was expanding manpower in a wartime environment. But the way it was doing it still reflected control, narrow categories, careful selection, and a segregated training system built alongside the policy change.
So for those who want to know, $750,000 back in 1942 is worth $14.9 million to $15.7 million in today's dollars.
Yeah.
I still see, as much as that is, like, on a personal level, that's a lot, but for a military facility, I even back then...
Yeah, but one that's supposed to be temporary.
True.
This was only supposed to be temporary.
Yeah.
They were going to do this to prove that they would fail and then tear it all down.
Yeah.
So, it's worth slowing down here because a common misunderstanding is that EO 8802 fixed the problem, that Randolph declared victory, and that everybody went home satisfied. The reality is messier. Randolph's decision to call off the march was a strategic choice based on a concrete concession. But the order itself didn't erase discrimination. It created a tool to challenge it, and those tools only matter if people keep using them. The National Archives description of the FEPC record group shows the committee moving through multiple bureaucratic homes and reorganizations during the war years, which is a very government way of saying enforcement was contested, political, and constantly negotiated. In other words, the door didn't open because the Marine Corps suddenly wanted it open. It opened because the cost of keeping it shut was rising, and the people pushing on it had learned how to make the cost visible. Once June 1st, 1942 hits, the Marine Corps is operating under a new set of constraints. There's national scrutiny, there's wartime necessity, there's a precedent of executive action in the defense sphere. And there's a growing awareness that black Americans aren't asking for participation. They're demanding it, and they figured out how to force the issue. The unwritten record post from the National Archives draws a straight line from EO 8802's context to the moment Alfred Mast is sworn in nearly a year later, framing that enlistment as a turning point. And once that first enlistment happens, it isn't just one man. The story becomes volume. The Barracks/Quantico Marine Corps article notes that after Masters, more than 900 other African Americans enlisted. JSTOR Daily similarly notes the early quota filling quickly. So now the Marine Corps has a problem it can't solve with rhetoric. It has recruits, real ones, lots of them. And the system must put them somewhere. So, by mid-1942, the decision has been made. Black Americans would be allowed to enlist, and recruiting was underway. But the way the door opens tells you what comes next. Because the Marine Corps isn't opening its existing training depot saying, come on in. It's building something separate, fast, controlled, and designed from the ground up to keep segregation intact while still producing Marines. Next, we're going to walk into that place. How it was constructed, why it was positioned the way it was, and how the physical design of the camp reflects the deeper reality, acceptance on paper, separation in practice. Montford Point wasn't just a separate training camp in the abstract. It was separation you could see and separation you could feel before you ever heard a drill instructor's cadence. Because the Marine Corps didn't just decide to segregate black recruits on paper. It built segregation into the landscape. Montford Point sat adjacent to Camp Lejeune, but accounts from the period make it clear that the conditions were treated as a different world nearby, yet not comparable. And the way you arrived there mattered. One Marine Corps historical exhibit describes coming off Highway 24 and taking a narrow, about a mile-long road that runs through a corridor of tall pines before opening into a clearing. The exhibit emphasizes that this approach made an indelible impression on recruits, because it didn't feel like rolling up to the front gate of a prestigious institution. It felt like being routed somewhere deliberately out of sight. The physical experience is essential. It's not just scenery, it's a message. You're here, you're needed, and you're still being placed apart.
Camp Lejeune being said, being a prestigious institution.
Yeah.
I'm sure if there's any Marines listening to us, they probably just choked after hearing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, early Munford Point was built like a functional wartime cantonment. Quick, practical, and not designed to impress. Preservation documents describe the first facilities as temporary frame construction, later followed by more permanent-looking structures as the camp expanded. And there's a reason that matters for how the place felt. When a facility is built like it could be packed up tomorrow, it tells the people living there something they don't need spelled out. This isn't meant to be your place for long. It implies the institution is still thinking in terms of experiment, exception, or workaround. Even as it trains men who are staking their identity on a permanent title, Marine. The same exhibit gives a remarkably concrete snapshot of what recruits saw in that clearing. It lists a headquarters building, a chapel, warehouses, a dispensary, and a mess hall, nicknamed the Greasy Spoon by recruits. It also describes a theater building with two wings that later housed a library, barbershop, and classification room, while the other side served as a recreation slop shoot, essentially a beer hall. Must be fucking nice.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Then it lands on the detail that really sells the individual, or sells the visual. 120 green prefabricated huts, each designed to billet 16 men. Again, must be nice.
Yeah.
Just keep in mind, when we went to basic, it was in a room with, let's see, you've got each person in a bunk bed, and you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, at least 10 bunk beds in a row, and then across from that another 10, and then around the corner is two more rows.
I think it's like 21 on each side, so roughly about 42 for the whole bay.
Yeah, and then you multiply that by two because it's a bunk bed.
Yeah.
So you've got 84 people in two rooms, and then if you're lucky, if all the showers are working, you've got 8 showers-ish.
You got real quick on learning how to just...
I mean, shit, shower, shave, done. Yep. I used to pour that shit on top of my head, let it run all down. I was done. Mm-hmm. That was bathing. So 16 men, I'll take it.
Yeah, I mean, I got down to like being able to take like a 3-minute full body shower.
Yeah. So picture it. A handful of real buildings, administration, medical, food supply, surrounded by rows of identical green huts, efficient, uniform, contained. A place designed to process bodies into Marines at scale, but still keep them in a clearly defined perimeter of over there. Several descriptions of Munford Point stress that the land itself wasn't gentle. Marine Parents, for example, which is a magazine, describes the area, I think it's also now a website, describes the area as swampy and harsh, with brackish creeks, poison ivy, heavy insects, and in general, this place is trying to eat you alive vibe. So,
North Carolina.
Yeah, it is a website too.
Yeah, it used to be just a magazine. Even if you strip away from the social reality and look at the physical one, you're left with a camp where discomfort is baked into daily life. Heat, dampness, bugs, mud. And that sense that the easiest way to endure it is to harden into a unit. Listen, I grew up in Florida. That was daily life in Florida. And that's the thing. Munford Point didn't only separate recruits. It also forged them, because surviving a tough place together builds a particular kind of bond. I can picture a Florida recruit going, what are y'all complaining about?
Yeah.
I live this every day.
because a lot of the recruits would have probably been coming from New York or Chicago, where this stuff doesn't
exist. And then you get the Florida, Georgia, Mississippi boys that are going, eh, whatever. We played in this. As the camp's role grew, Monford Point didn't stay just huts and essentials. Planning documents describe a significant build out by mid-1943, with new buildings constructed of tile block with stucco veneers, including a larger administration building, an infirmary, a hostess house, a brig, a post theater, classroom buildings, and gun sheds. And later, in 1943, a training pool was added. Again, not just a practical facility, but proof that this is no longer a small temporary solution. It's a system with infrastructure. Leave it to a branch of the Navy to put a pool in.
I mean, you got to learn how to swim.
Yeah. So the camp evolves in a way that's almost narratively perfect. Starts out looking like something thrown together quickly, then grows into something more permanent looking as the war effort demands more from it. Whether or not the institution ever wanted to admit it, it created something lasting. Now we've got the setting, the road in, the clearing, the green huts, the buildings that look temporary until you realize how many lives pass through them. Next, we step inside the routine, what it meant to wake up in that camp, live under segregation, and be shaped into Marines day after day, how training worked, what daily life felt like, and how a place designed to separate people ended up creating a bond that was hard to break. Monford Point wasn't just boot camp, but separate. It was boot camp where every single routine from the first time you lined up to the first time you stepped off base reminded you that you were being measured twice, once against Marine standards and once against the institution's doubts about whether you should even be there. One of the most telling things about Monford Point is that the official posture, at least from the first commander, was that black recruits would receive the same training as white recruits training nearby. Colonel Samuel A. Woods Jr., the first commander at Monford Point, explicitly insisted that the standard would be the standard, and he framed it in terms of basic human dignity. People do their duty when they're being treated like human beings. That line matters because it tells you the Corps already understood the real battle wasn't whether these men could handle boot camp. The battle was over whether the institution would treat them like Marines while training them to be Marines. And in practice, equal training didn't mean equal experience. Because the training itself, the drill, the discipline, the physical grind, was only one layer. The other layer was a social reality they lived inside. Segregation, hostility, and the constant understanding that failure wouldn't be seen as an individual shortcoming. It would be used as proof that the door should never have been opened. Marine parents describe Monford Point Boot Camp as a kind of non-stop motion machine. Constant activity, learning Marine discipline, and mastering combat skills like hand-to-hand fighting, rifles, and bayonets. That constant activity part is worth lingering on because it's the texture of boot camp people forget when they reduce it to a montage. The whole point is to break down the civilian rhythm in your head and replace it with something else. Moving when you're told. Speaking when you're told. Standing still when you're told. And doing it perfectly the first time, even when you're exhausted. Until you get the kid, I want to join the military, but if a recruiter would have, if a drill instructor would have gotten in my face, I would have punched him.
Yeah. I mean, the exhaustion is real. I remember falling asleep.
I would fall asleep standing up.
Falling asleep standing up and marching while I was sleeping.
Or sitting in classroom and huffing hand sanitizer or a marker.
Yes.
To stay awake. I would literally.
Well, we were always on edge because our female drill instructors would come in the middle of the night to mess with us sometimes.
No. It only happened a few times with me. That I can remember, right? I may or not have blocked out some parts of basic training.
Edwards!
Hey.
You have Firewatch.
Fuck you!
We didn't call it Firewatch, but...
What did you call it?
I forget, but it wasn't Firewatch. I know that much.
They changed the language in between our times.
Oh, fuck you.
We called it Firewatch.
Yeah, it was Firewatch.
I think it was an ECP dude.
Yeah, it was that, but...
We call it Firewatch.
The short term was Firewatch.
Never called it that. I'm just saying, we didn't... My
he comes from a different time.
Yeah.
It was in an 08.
It's a different. I was still in high school.
Same.
So in a segregated camp, that same machine is running, but it's running with an added psychological weight. You're not just trying to survive boot camp. You're trying to survive boot camp, and you're trying to survive being watched by a system that expects you to fail. So the pressure isn't only become a Marine, it's become a Marine in a way no one can argue with. Early on, the command structure and drill instructors were white, deliberately chosen for their experience as Marines and veterans, tasked with identifying black recruits who could be developed into leaders and instructors themselves. Over time, that changed, and when it didn't necessarily mean things got softer. JSTOR Daily includes a memory from a Montford Point trainee who recalled that recruits initially felt relieved when black drill instructors began replacing the ones who had been harsher, assuming they'd be less harsh. Instead, the black drill instructors pushed them harder, driven by a fierce determination that their men would succeed and be seen as real Marines. That's one of the most human, complicated truths of the Montford Point story. Sometimes the people who understand the stakes most intimately were the ones who applied the most pressure, because they knew exactly how little margin for error the institution was willing to grant. Wounded Warrior Project similarly notes that by 1945, every drill instructor at Montford Point and many NCOs, non-commissioned officers, were black after recruits were selected to become NCO drill instructors. So inside Montford Point, you have this intense feedback loop. The Corps is trying to maintain control through segregation. The men inside the segregated system build their own internal standards and leadership culture. And that culture becomes a forge because excellence is the only argument the institution can't dismiss. Even when training was equal on paper, daily life was structured to reinforce separation. The National Archives Unwritten Record post states plainly that Montford Point Marines endured racism that included not being allowed to enter Camp Lejeune unless accompanied by a white Marine. Wounded Warrior Project gives the same example as a snapshot of the racism they faced. That's not a just not a policy detail. It's a daily message. You can wear the uniform, but your movement still requires permission. You can be trained as a Marine, but you're still being treated as an outsider. And then there's the outside world. Marine Parents describes the surrounding community reality in Onslow County as a wall of segregation. Black Marines facing segregated and less comfortable seating on buses and trains and in theaters. Police requiring them to stay out of the white areas and being asked to leave establishments. So picture the emotional whiplash. You spend the day being told discipline is everything. You're part of an elite fighting force and you're earning the title. Then you step off base and get reminded in public that the South's segregation systems still sees you as somebody who needs to be controlled. Here's what makes Montford Point more than a story of oppression. The men there built community anyway. Marine parents note that despite being kept extremely busy, recruits still found moments for cards, conversations, cigarettes, sports, and sharing mail from home. Must be nice.
Seriously.
And that these small rituals formed a tight bond that helped balance the prejudice and intensity of training. And everybody became really religious in basic.
Yeah,
yes. I know a lot of people became Buddhist in basic because they meditated. So you would sleep. That's not fluff. That's survival. Because when you're being tested constantly, physically and socially, those tiny pieces of normalcy are how you stay human long enough to become what you came to be. The National Archives post backs up the idea through its photo captions. It describes Montford Point's recreation program as a vital morale builder, noting that daily movies were shown in on-base theaters. Again, must be nice.
Seriously.
It also describes the camp service club as a packed, popular off-duty spot.
Did you have the saying, grilled cheese and Jesus?
Yes. Sundays. Sundays were grilled cheese days.
Oh.
Yeah.
Grilled cheese and Jesus. For us, I know you guys probably... Grilled cheese wasn't invented then.
Uh-huh,
but grilled cheese and Jesus. You, on Sundays, it was grilled cheese for lunch. So in the morning, you woke up. Sundays were the only break you got. So Sundays, we got up. You didn't have to do PT. Sunday mornings. Nope.
Well, yeah, I did PT every
Sundays,
day.
We did it Monday through Saturday.
We did it a little bit, but it wasn't anywhere near as harsh.
Sundays, you got up. You went to the DFAC. Ate your breakfast, came home, got changed into your normal uniform, shit, shower, shave.
Yep.
Then go to the white ropes, got to leave a little earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go.
Well, white ropes was tech school.
We had white ropes in basic too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we didn't.
When I was there, we had to. It was only for tech school. You could be a rope.
And then then you went to whatever service they had. Basically, had a service for almost every denomination, including Buddhism
and Wicca.
Yeah. So you would go to each one. Obviously, at that time, I was a Christian, so I went to the Christian service, and you had a full church service. You had worship. You had
communion,
preaching, all of that. And then you left and you went to lunch, and it was grilled cheese, and it was everybody's favorite part. And then you got to Sundays, or when we got to make phone calls, we got to do the phone calls home. And then it's also where everybody kind of caught up on letters and stuff too.
Yeah.
Like we were able to write for parts of the week, depending on how good we were. But you were able to get your cell phone. You had an hour to call everybody.
I can't remember.
We had an hour.
I remember only calling home like the beginning and toward the end.
I did the initial call, initial like, hey, blah, blah, blah. Here's my address. I made it. Goodbye. I'll call you later.
Yeah. And the person had to memorize the phone number, and the person had to answer the phone, or you could not leave a message.
I was lucky that my mom had the same phone number my entire life, so I had it memorized already. So I did that, and then the first like two, I think it was the first week or so, you didn't get a call.
No.
And then once you got your, like, you got into the basic stuff, like you got your uniforms, all of that, then you were able to do calls on Sundays. I remember getting calls taken away one week because we were bad.
We got calls taken away, but we also got shortened. Like, typically, like, okay, like, you have, like, a half-hour hour. And then sometimes it got cut down.
Yeah.
My drill instructors, they used to do a couple times, they would throw off the wall questions that you, because they could ask you, and you had to answer questions about chain of command.
Yeah.
And they'd be like, all right, for whoever gets this right gets a 15-minute call home, or like, no, it's a 10 or 15 minute, either one. But they would ask you the most obscure question, like, who is the Secretary of the Air Force? And we had memorized our own, like, our chain of command, but anything beyond that, nobody read it, because we were told specifically, don't worry about it. And then he would ask us questions, and I think there was like one kid got it, and that my drill instructor like gave him like the, like, he's like, I'm gonna fucking kill you. Go call home. Okay.
Yeah. Our phones were in a locked case, and they were kept in the drill instructors. They had their little office/bedroom that was in there.
Yeah.
And they would pull them out on Sundays, and they would go, all right, Freeman, blah, 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 and hand them out. You got to sit down, and you had to stay on your bed or in front of your locker. And so Ben would hate it because he can't pace while talking on the phone.
Yeah.
And I would make my phone calls, be like, hey, I only have like 10 minutes to talk. And so you call everybody really quickly and catch them up. So, yeah. Even those small details matter, because they show something crucial. Montford Point wasn't only a pipeline, it was a lived-in place. A place where men were being shaped, yes, but also a place where they laughed, blew off steam, tried to carve out a little dignity in a system designed to deny it. The unwritten record post also points to the everyday rituals of becoming a Marine, such as clothing issues and recruits in dress blues, as shown in archival photographs from Montford Point. That matters because a uniform wasn't just fabric. For many, it was evidence. Evidence they belonged, evidence that they could meet the standard, evidence the Corps' old story about who could be a Marine was no longer defensible. That's why this resonates emotionally. Montford Point was designed to keep Black recruits separate, physically, socially, and symbolically. But the training itself did something the Marine Corps couldn't fully control. It created Marines. And once you have Marines, you have people who insist on being treated like Marines. By the time a recruit made it through Montford Point, the transformation wasn't theoretical. The discipline, the weapons training, the leadership pressure, even the off-base hostility, they were all shaping men for a purpose. Next, we're going to talk about what that purpose looked like in practice, what roles the Marine Corps expected Montford Pointers to fill, why those roles were strategically important, and how the men trained at Montford Point started changing the Corps not just by existing in uniform, but by becoming indispensable. So by the time a Montford Point recruit earned the title, the Marine Corps wasn't just thinking, congratulations. It was thinking, now where do we put you? Because the moment black men became Marines, the institution had to answer a second question it had been trying to avoid. What kind of Marines would it allow them to be? And the early answer was control through structure. Instead of folding Montford Pointers into existing units across the Corps, the Marine Corps built a pipeline that funneled them into segregated units and narrowly defined job categories. Units that were essential to war, but also easier to isolate, supervise, and contain within the old rules. One Camp Lejeune Montford Point display makes this clear in an almost clinical way. The first African-American Marine Corps combat unit was the 51st Defense Battalion, activated August 18, 1942, at Montford Point. Soon after, the Secretary of the Navy authorized a Marine Corps messman branch and the first of 63 combat support companies, either depot or ammunition units, plus the 2nd Defense Battalion, the 52nd. That list tells you what the Corps was building, a set of lanes that were absolutely necessary to a wartime Marine Corps. Base defense, supply, ammunition, handling, depot operations, food service. But lanes that were also easier to segregate and keep separate from the Corps' core identity story.
So for those that don't know what messman branch is, it is their roles and duties were as messmen and stewards were to serve meals to officers, clean the cabins, polish shoes, and perform other tasks.
Yeah, they were slaves. I mean, essentially.
Yeah.
That's what they were. So they weren't being placed randomly. They were being placed deliberately. And the messman branch detail is especially revealing. Food service is real work, vital work, and it keeps units functioning. Still, historically, it was also a role used to limit upward mobility and keep black service members out of combat arms and leadership tracks. Because even to this day, being part of the mess MOS, it's hard to get a higher rank.
I know when I was deployed, in our mess, it was like other nationalities cooking, yeah. And that it wasn't the military.
Yeah.
The only time I really saw military cooks in that were when I was stateside and stationed at Charleston.
Yeah.
Bastards gave me food poisoning.
Our DFAC was, my base DFAC was closed.
Hampton didn't have one.
I ate at Burger King all the time.
I will say the Army's food is actually pretty decent.
I ate at Burger King a lot because there was a Burger King right in front of where the DFAC was.
Even Fort Drum's mess wasn't that bad if you could actually get anything from them. Those miserable bastards. Yeah.
Burger King burnt down.
Hanscom, they didn't have a DFAC, and the Burger King there was absolutely disgusting.
So Burger King and Subway had contracts with the military, at least the Air Force. So the pipeline wasn't just graduate and go. It involved selection, who got slotted into the units, the Corps deemed combat ready, and who got funneled into support formations. Wounded Warrior Project notes that in late 1942, a group of 600 recruits was selected for the 51st in 52nd composite defense battalions. Again, composite being temporary. That's a significant number, and it's early, meaning the Corps is quickly building segregated units with real organizational weight. Then 1943 becomes a breakthrough year inside that system, not because segregation disappears, but because leadership begins emerging from within the Montford Point population itself. In January 1943, PFC Edgar Huff becomes the first black NCO. February 1943, Gilbert Hashmark Johnson, feel like he's from the South.
Probably.
Gilbert Hashmark Johnson becomes Montford Point's first drill sergeant. And he and Huff gained reputations as two of the most authoritarian leaders there.
And for those that don't know what PFC is, it's private first class.
Ain't that right, Edwards?
Don't be talking to me like that.
So, because the pipeline didn't merely assign jobs, it produced proof. Every black NCO promoted, every black drill instructor developed, every unit formed and functioning, those weren't internal milestones. They were arguments the institution couldn't shrug off. A Marine Corps Museum profile reinforces Johnson's significance in that leadership pipeline. It notes he transferred from the U.S. Navy to the Marine Corps in 1942 and became one of the first black drill instructors in 1943. So when people talk about Montford Point as a training camp, it's easy to miss that it was also a leadership factory, one that the Corps built because it wanted segregation and then later couldn't fully control because the men inside it became too capable to ignore. Here's what the Marine Corps intent and reality started to drift apart. Marine Parents describes how overseas assignments were initially not intended to put Montford Point Marines in combat because they were viewed as unfit to serve, and that they were instead often assigned to duty stations outside combat zones in the Pacific. It notes that the 51st and 52nd Defense Battalions were primarily created to draw guard duty on islands already secured. That's the institutional mindset in plain language. We will use you, but we will try to control where and how you are seen. But even without getting into battlefield detail, the logic collapses under its own weight. Because the roles the Corps was assigning, air and coastal defense, guarding strategic positions, ammunition and depot work, aren't background roles in global war. They are the infrastructure of combat. Ammunition doesn't deliver itself. Bases don't defend themselves. Supply lines don't run on vibes and patriotism. Even when someone tries to frame your contribution as support, the war treats it as a matter of survival. So the pipeline mattered for two reasons at once. One, it was how the Corps tried to keep segregation intact while still expanding manpower, because it's the Marines. And two, it accidentally set the stage for the Corps to be changed from within, because once you train and organize thousands of Marines into units that are essential to operations, those Marines stop being optional. Montford Point wasn't just producing men who could meet the standard. It was producing units and leaders that the Corps needed. So, by the end of this part of the story, Montford Point isn't just a location, and it isn't just a moment in civil rights history. It's a system that took segregation and tried to turn it into a permanent boundary, and instead created Marines who made that boundary harder and harder to defend. So in this final section, we're going to pull back and talk about what Montford Point ultimately means, why the story still matters, what it tells us about institutions that change only under pressure, and how a place built to separate people ended up forging a legacy that couldn't be kept over there. By the end of this episode, the most important thing to understand about Montford Point is that it wasn't an add-on to the Marine Corps history. It was a test of what the Marine Corps, and really what the country, meant when it said like words like duty, honor, and service. Because Montford Point sits in that uncomfortable space where two truths exist at the same time. The Marine Corps needed these men, but the Marine Corps didn't want these men. And that contradiction shaped everything. Montford Point was built as a solution that sought to satisfy both impulses at once. Accept black recruits while keeping the institution's existing identity intact by placing that change at a distance, both physically and socially. It was the logic of segregation in uniform, participation without belonging. But history has this habit of breaking systems that try to control it. Because once you create Marines, once you put men through the standard, give them the title and demand the discipline, you can't fully dictate what that title will mean to them. You can try to fence them off, but you can't stop them from internalizing the same pride, the same standards, and the same claim to the identity you just issued them. That's what Montford Point really represents, not just the first black Marines, but the moment the Corps began losing the ability to pretend it could be elite while also being exclusionary. Because those two things can't coexist forever once the people you excluded start meeting your standard. And there's another layer here that matters beyond the Marine Corps. Monford Point forces us to confront a bigger American pattern. Institutions rarely change because they wake up one morning with a sudden moral epiphany. They change because staying the same is too costly under pressure, politically, economically, culturally, or operationally. So when we talk about Monford Point's meaning, it isn't just look how far we've come. It's also a warning label. Progress is often reactive, often reluctant, and usually comes with conditions attached. The door opens, but someone tries to stand in the frame and decides how wide it gets. And that's where the men at Monford Point become more than a historical chapter. They became proof. Proof that segregation could not stop competence. Proof that discipline and excellence could be built even inside a system designed to deny dignity. Proof that the definition of Marine was never going to stay locked in a private club once men had earned the title the institution tried so hard to keep out. So, if you take one thing out of this episode, let it be this. Monford Point wasn't simply a place where Black Americans became Marines. It was a place where the Marine Corps began slowly, unwillingly, but irreversibly being forced to become something closer to what it claimed to be. Next time, we will follow what happens after the transformation. Would Monford Point Marines leave the training grounds and step into the war itself? Where the work they were assigned and the sacrifices they made didn't just change policy, they challenged the story the Marine Corps told about who belonged. And we'll also discuss some of the awards that were given to the men. The Monford Marines were highly decorated during the war. Some of the most highly decorated in Marine Corps history.
And we'll also talk about the ones that were the first ones to get like the high awards, like the Medal of Honor.
Yeah, things like that. The Navy Cross. We'll be discussing all of that. So, and then I just want to let everybody know soon here in the next week or two, you'll see a video going up on our TikTok and on our YouTube. We had the pleasure of visiting the Auschwitz Museum. It came to visit here in Cincinnati at Cincinnati Museum. So we did go visit that museum, took pictures and video and things like that. We thought it was pretty fitting given what we've been talking about. So we will be putting all that together and throwing that video up and so everybody can see it and see what it's like and see when the Auschwitz Museum is coming near you, because it does travel around. So it was really cool to see, really intense. But yeah, so thank you for joining us tonight in the Scarlet Tavern, where the candles burn low, the stories burn deep, and the truth is always one drink away. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. Open your eyes, look towards the skies and